Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. This week on the show, I have Miriam Sagan here. She's going to be talking about her new book, Stash, and I'll give Miriam a few seconds to introduce herself and just let us all know what she has planned coming up. Miriam, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me on. And I'm in Santa Fe on an autumn afternoon. I've been retired for a bunch of years from Santa Fe Community College, where I ran a creative writing program, and I've been focused a lot on doing my own work in the past few years. I'm working in every genre available to me. Some are easier than others. I love writing poetry. It's my first craft, and I've really done it my whole life. I enjoy memoir, and the little book, Dash, combines personal autobiographical poetry with what one might call flash memoir, similar to flash fiction, but autobiographical. And I'm also kind of struggling with a novella that I'm revising about a post-apocalyptic world set in Albuquerque and also in some mythological realms. I've published a few novels, but they're always a lot more daunting for me than a shorter form would be. So that's kind of what I'm doing. Thanks for asking.
Oh, that's great. I always find it so interesting with authors, what each of us find interesting and easy and more up our alley than others. It's so specific to an individual person.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your first book, Dart Again, your book of poetry.
It's not my first book. I've actually probably published about 30, 35 books and chapbooks over the years. Start Again came out in January, so it was, I'm still sort of feeling it's a new book, although it's starting to feel more familiar. It was published by Red Mountain Press, and I've worked with them for many years. I think it's the fourth book that they published, so that was really great. A lot of it comes out of the pandemic and that quality of isolation, so some of the themes from that time period are in the book.
I admit I'm not well-versed in poetry, but I was really enjoying reading your poems and Start Again. And that's interesting to know that a lot of that was throughout the pandemic. It puts it a little bit more in perspective for me on when I was reading it.
That's good to know.
Now with Dash, this was a really interesting read for me. Like you said, it's kind of like a flash memoir, which is a little different from other memoir styles that I've read in the past. So tell me how you decided to put this together, because I know from working with some other authors who have been doing memoir, trying to figure out how to formulate a memoir and what to include and what not to include is really challenging. So how did you approach that process?
Well, it's a huge issue that you're describing, and I think no matter how acquainted you are with the territory, it remains full of questions. I've written different kinds of memoirs. When my first husband died as a young man, this is many years ago, I wrote a memoir about that experience called Searching for Mustard Seed, and that was a traditional prose memoir, chapter by chapter. A big question for me writing that was, where did I start? Right? He and I had been married for 13 years and together for more than that. Did I start when we met? Did I start when he got sick? Where did it end? It sounds simple, but it was perplexing. And that was written fairly traditionally. And I was very content with that when it came out. It seemed to communicate to other people. And also I had gotten the pretty volatile subject matter to be responsive to my technical approach. About 3 or 4 years ago, I published a book called 100 Cups of Coffee, published by Tres Chicas Press in northern New Mexico, which was a kind of a silly grid, but it worked, where I just decided I would drink 100 cups of coffee and write each time I drank a cup of coffee. And it took me 2 years. And in that time, my mom died, and there was a presidential election, and all kinds of things happened. I think there's a little bit of a weakness in the book in that I just wrote whenever I felt like it, rather than saying I got to write every day. And someone who read it said it seems like it's more like 100 writing exercises than 100 cups of coffee, which is really true. But that was very enjoyable as well. When I sat down to write Stash, I had some trouble. I had a lovely writer's residency in Truth or Consequences, and Truth or Consequences can be very relaxing, but I was a little bit agitated. I wanted to put in some things that I'd never written about, but it turned out some of those things were bad things or maybe things I didn't really own. And so I had to kind of walk that narrow path between what's mine to talk about and what isn't. And it ended up being much more about my childhood than I had expected and my family. Not the first time I've written about them, but maybe the most formal way. I talk about the four seasons, and there's some pieces that are called haibun, which is where prose is combined with a haiku. So the haiku is kind of like a little ping or a little bell sound at the end of the prose section, and then added in the poems. To me, I think the central theme in the book is really about becoming a writer and the different things in childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood that either helped that or hindered it. So there had so many versions, I can't tell you. There's probably like 9 failed versions, hopefully in the trash in my computer. But this one finally came to the light of day. So that's sort of the process that happened behind it.
I think it did come together really well. Like I said, it was a different format than what I'd read before, but I really enjoyed just getting these little tiny glimpses into your life, and each one had a specific theme. And really, short-form writing is not my specialty.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
So I'm
okay.
I'm always really interested in how people can pack so much into so few words. And one of the ones, it's right toward the beginning, the section called In Autumn. And there was a line that I really liked and I wanted to talk with you about. And the line was, habits died hard even in childhood. And later on, all of childhood seemed a habit it was impossible to break.
Yes.
That one really stood out to me because I think as adults, so much of our childhood experiences really do stick with us, and we're working through them probably up until the day we die.
Uh-huh.
But
I
just wanted to chat with you a little bit about that concept because it kind of comes up multiple times throughout Stash in different ways. And was that an intentional theme that kept cropping back up, or just kind of how life is that it kept coming up?
That's a great way to put it. I think that is how life is, and that oftentimes when a person's writing, then the theme begins to surface. There's like an obsession or something that's just an itch you have to scratch, something that the writer keeps returning to, and then eventually becomes conscious. And you can look at it and say, oh, yes, this is one of my themes. I mean, I think childhood is so luminous in a lot of ways that when we're children, we perceive, you know, without as much social conditioning and emotional labeling than as we do as adults. I mean, the way a child takes in things through the senses is and the imagination is pretty extraordinary. And, of course, we lose that. My dad could be very funny, and he once said, never argue with a child because the child has nothing to do except try to win your argument, and you're going to ask yourself, did I pay my federal income tax on time, or did I leave the kettle on, and you're going to lose the argument. So that one-point focus of childhood, it's a remarkable thing. And, you know, I have a daughter, and I have a granddaughter, and many, many nieces and nephews, and I've seen all of them go from that extraordinary, magical quality of childhood perception and then grow up, learn to read, learn to have friends, learn how to go to the grocery store. I do think writing is an attempt sometimes for a lot of us, maybe all of the art, to recapture that primary kind of experience that we have as children.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's very exploratory, any of the art, whether it's writing, painting, sculpting. I think it really just provides an emotional and mental connection to other points in our life that I think a lot of times, you know, you're trying to work through when you're creating something, no matter what it is. And
I think you're so right. I think you're so right. You know, even if you were really building a suspension bridge, I mean, just children are always trying to build a suspension bridge. There's just a quality of innovation, really, in childhood that's quite admirable.
Yeah. You know, there's so many new experiences as a child, and you're just constantly learning and trying to take it all in. And another point that it kind of came back up was in the short story, The Stupid Man Club, and talk about how, you know, as children, they're watching these other people around them and the adults, and they're just like, I think you put it, the incomprehensibility of adults in your life. There's just like, what is happening?
I think that's so funny.
So true for kids.
I mean, my sister and I did have a club called the Stupid Man Club. Obviously, it was my idea. I was the older one, right? I took the notes. And we followed around anybody who came in the house. And I had really forgotten about it. When I started to write, it came to life. And then, of course, you know, at the end of that piece, I kind of refer to my father as a member of the Stupid Man Club because he also came and went. You know what I mean? He was working very hard when we were kids, and you know, he was incomprehensible too. And it's just always entertained me that I spent my childhood sort of trying to get other people to do creative projects with me. I think that sort of predicted my adult life as a teacher and working in the community and all of that.
I can definitely see that, yeah, just in reading your poetry and some of these stories. You seem to have a very creative and exploratory nature of let's find new things, let's try new stuff and discover the world around us. And I think that's such a great attitude to have.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm not sure we have any choice in this matter. I mean, I've sort of been, you know, driven by the muse of curiosity for a very long time.
When you're someone who observes a lot around you and you're trying to understand that, whether child or adult, it really just inspires this sense of, I want to understand the things happening around me. And I think as kids, sometimes you feel a little lost in the bigger world.
Totally.
And then as you start to understand a little bit more of what's going on with the adults around you, it starts to come into focus a little bit more. But you mentioned in one part that your dad was that introduction to how complex people and society is.
Yes.
And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that.
I can see that you are a really good reader. It's really nice to to experience. My father, Eli Sagan, was an extremely unusual person. I have a sibling who said that they didn't really realize that he wasn't a normal person until we were all in our 40s because he dominated the environment. He was a child of immigrants, and he'd been in business with his father. They were very successful, and he threw it all up when he was about 39 and became a freelance academic and wrote a lot of books, had success publishing them, and he was a very politically active person. He was a very, very strong believer in justice and equality, and at the height of the 60s and early 70s, he was extremely active. He was actually on President Nixon's enemies list, which made him very pleased with himself and upset my mother no end. She didn't want horrifying publicity, you know what I mean? But my dad was stuck up about his activism, and he was a very visionary person. But he was also, in some ways, an emotionally fragile person and thin-skinned. He suffered easily, and when he suffered, he got mad. And I think that the world was not always that congenial to him. In retrospect, you know, as an adult, I would say, you know, he loved humanity, but people drove him crazy. And I think there was that. He was also, you know, very funny and tough, born in New Jersey, raised in New Jersey, you know, and I'm raised in New Jersey, too. I was thinking about it today, how I'm almost 70 years old, but I'll always have some bad habits that I picked up having been raised in New Jersey, being rude and vengeful, all of those things. So my dad was like that, too. But he's one of those people, they could be difficult in life, but once they're gone, once they're dead, I quote him constantly. And I ask myself, what would he do? And sometimes I even ask him, although he's long dead, you know, hey, what should I do? And I always get a really good, practical, slightly sarcastic answer. He was an unusual person to have as a parent. He was not your just, you know, kind of take your bowling kind of guy. So I hope that answers the question a little bit.
Yeah, those early influences in life and when you have big personalities and someone who does have that big presence, it really impacts you and it can change how you see the world and how you approach the world. I think that's really interesting that he went from a regular expected career and did something completely unexpected, probably especially for the time period, becoming a freelance academic. There's, I'm sure, a lot of people in his life who were like, what are you doing?
I think my mom was one of those people. And between you and me, we were stunned because he worked very hard in the business and then suddenly he's home all the time trying to chat with us and driving us to music lessons. It was very unsettling. And he tried to learn to cook. That didn't go very well. It was kind of an amazing experience. He was an early supporter of feminism, and he decided he would do some of the cooking, and he did not provide full meals, let me just put it that way.
Sounds like someone who definitely inspired a lot of creativity and interest in the world around you.
Oh, absolutely. I think that even my grandfather, who I obviously knew less well than my dad, but who was also a very complicated person. I mean, a person without education, but who loved opera, loved painting, loved beauty. They just had that quality of what you might call creative problem solving. They liked a problem. And it could be a mundane problem, like, you know, a truck is broken down, or it could be a huge problem, like, why can't people get on with each other? They love to problem. They love to approach it. And that modeling is super helpful for a life as a writer.
There's always roadblocks in completing a creative project, and I don't think you ever solve them the same way twice.
That's a very good point. You know, I want to ask you, what are you writing? You said you don't, the short form is kind of looks flashy to you. Are you a novelist?
I am typically a novelist, yeah. I've done some journalism in the past. It was an interesting learning experience to try to limit myself to under 1,000 words for most stories.
Yes, yes. I was a freelancer for over a decade in New Mexico. I think I worked for every publication in the state as a stringer. I mean, it's hacking. And I have to say, it was, you really learn a lot. You know, you learn a lot to be on deadline and just to produce. And maybe it's not really that good, but it's over. So.
Yeah, definitely a different focus, and you have to kind of shift your mindset depending on what you're writing and what format and what style. It was a great learning experience for me. I may go back to it someday. We'll see what happens.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, typically novelists, and they tend to be fairly long, so keeping things short is always my problem.
It might not be a problem. I mean, it's typical enough of the novel to go on, but it's interesting what you're saying.
There was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, another topic, a theme, I guess, that came up a couple times in staff. And that was the idea of being real. And there were a couple of minutes that came out. Once in the Medusa story, where, you know, as children, you kind of hit this point where it's like, oh, we are real people, part of society. Instead of that, like, kind of outsider child feeling of observation, like, oh, we're in the middle of it. We're part of this whole thing now. And that idea of, how do you define yourself within a society? Do you belong? Are you on the outside? And that may be different from someone else's perspective. And so that was an interesting one that came up, and I wanted to get a little bit more of your thoughts on that.
Well, thank you. I think childhood is, by its nature at least, I mean, I was raised in the 50s. It was a disenfranchised state. In today's world, children get to make more decisions than people did in my family. It was an authoritarian structure. I mean, there was Dr. Spock and all that, but in some ways, there was a late Victorian structure of who had authority. In that little piece, Medusa, what happens is that it happens fast because it's a short piece, but my sisters and I become adolescents, right? We start to turn into women. And that's a process where we feel very empowered. It's about having autonomy, sexuality, intellect. Those are things that we didn't have previously. And I think it's almost like in that piece, and in life, it wasn't like we really had those things, but we had a whiff of them, the sensation that we could have those things, that we could really be the captains of our own destiny. And that's that feeling of being real. When you're a child, people put you in the car and take you to wherever you're going, and then you get out, and that's it, and you have to go to school, right? But adults don't function that way. Adults really do have a lot more autonomy. So I think that sensation of reality for me was a sensation of adolescence, of being able to act in the world and respond to the world.
Suddenly feel like you do have some control and some power in your own life. And
absolutely.
That is something I think in a big moment in childhood. And I think adults too, at different points in our lives, we hit those moments of like, you know, oh, no, I do have control over this situation, at least in part.
I think in childhood, you only have the power to resist, right? It's you can do something clandestine. You can have to eat everything on your plate. And you can feed it to the dog, but you can't walk away from the plate. Well, as an adult, if somebody says you have to eat everything on your plate, you're like, you in whose army, essentially, right?
yeah.
we have more bodily autonomy as adults, really.
Yes, and that makes such a huge difference in how you perceive the world around you and your place in it, I think.
Absolutely.
Another of the stories that went along with that theme was This Island Is Not Real. And I really enjoyed this one. It was a different age than a lot of the other short stories, and really showed you a little bit more on that cusp of adulthood. And you said that realization of what control you had over your life, and that you could look at a situation and say, no, this is important, even if other people in my life don't necessarily see it that way.
Right. And that, I think you've hit something with that, because in that piece of flash memoir, I'm probably 17 years old. It's the summer before I'm a senior in high school, and my boyfriend was in college at that time. I had known him for a couple of years, and he came to New York City, and we had some freedom. I had the afternoons off, and we weren't supervised, and I was taking classes at the New School, which is a great institution in New York, and I had a mean, terrible, hostile creative writing teacher. And as it says in the flash memoir, I mean, I wasn't going to complain about it. My parents were paying, right? I had a writing teacher who, you know, wasn't in high school, and I had written, which obviously in retrospect is a terrible short story, but maybe not that bad for a 17-year-old. And the veracity of it did not strike her as very deep. She just felt this is not realistic, and she was probably right. And that raised the question, even at the time for me, which is like, what's real? Again, what's authentic? Maybe authentic is the best word. What's authentic? What can stand on its own? And so from the viewpoint of many, many, many years later, what was authentic to me was what you might call being in New York City, having a body and being in the city and walking in the heat and getting a little snack and then seeing my boyfriend lean out of the second story window and, you know, how much I loved him and even though there were going to be problems later on, and how I could never have written about that then. I was writing about something more mythic or removed, but when I put the two together, it gelled, because part of it is that the island is an unnamed Caribbean island, and of course, New York has always been very Caribbean in its influences. But Manhattan's an island too, right? So Manhattan was my real island. And it's funny, I'm very fond of that piece. I'm glad you noticed it.
It really stuck out to me. I thought it was not only a fun one, and the thought of your creative writing teacher at the time being so harsh just killed me. Like, don't stomp on people's dreams. I hate that.
I hate it too, you know, and it's so funny. You think, why would a person do that to a bunch of kids, you know?
I know.
Who knows? Maybe we were going to fail, but you could at least have been nice.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't hurt to get some positive, constructive criticism and
exactly
encourage someone to keep exploring and trying. You never know what'll come of them.
I know.
Too many stories of people nobody believed in and they end up doing awesome things. So. No, and along that same line, you mentioned in Summer reality, and I think you put it, was it the random cruelty of the universe? And
yes.
I thought that fit so well here toward the end of just, I imagine, kind of looking back through this process of writing Dash and going through these memories and just seeing some of those moments, the good ones and then the ones that maybe weren't so good or that left a little bit more of a mark than others, and how we perceive those then and as an adult looking back on that.
Yeah, it's funny. I had one of those, if I knew then what I know now, moments in that we did see a wasp basically paralyze a caterpillar and lay its eggs in the caterpillar, and we were very excited. This was, you know, a piece of natural history, and we were observing it. And many years later, I read a biography of Charles Darwin, and seeing that wasp do that to a caterpillar shook his faith in a benign God. I mean, which was certainly a late Victorian experience, and he obviously, even though he's trained as a clergyman, he was about to embark upon the theory of evolution, which was going to put him at odds with conventional religion. But it just broke his heart. It devastated him. He couldn't believe something so terrible was happening. And I thought, you know, I had seen it as a child, and it hadn't meant anything to me because the universe had seemed random and cruel, as opposed to Charles Darwin, who obviously had a better quality of faith. And how you experience things very profoundly sometimes, but without full knowledge of how they can be interpreted or what even they might, quote, mean. So I was just lucky that I remembered that. And I love natural history, and I love the history of science and all of that. So the other piece of information came to me, and I started thinking about Charles Darwin, surprisingly enough.
Interesting those connections you make when you're thinking back on things, and I think that's the really cool thing about reflection is that it's not just like, oh, I remember this thing that happened. You remember it in a context of that moment that happened along with everything that's happened since then.
Yes,
and it really,
absolutely,
I think, just gives so much more depth to a memory when you can look at it in the past. In the moment, everything's in the moment. You know, it's the whole focus, and you can miss so many other aspects of a moment when you're in it.
No, that's very true. Do you find that a lot of writers or even you yourself sort of struggle with an idea that something is true and that we should try to figure out what's true and communicate it? Because I've seen people torture themselves that way.
Yeah, I think along that line is just everyone's experience is so unique, and it's so
Yes.
hard to communicate something so personal and so unique and really give someone, this is exactly what I experienced, because someone else is always going to have their experiences, their history, their background that influences how they perceive and even just how they hear someone else's story.
Right,
But I
exactly.
think that's a really cool thing about memoir is that the more you learn about other people's experiences, the more it can broaden your view of everything, really.
No, absolutely. And that's, I mean, I think that's part of the key to writing fiction is a combination of empathy and observation.
Absolutely. I can't think right off the top of my head who said it, but there's a quote that's something along the lines of people who don't read live one life, people who read live a thousand lives.
Right. No,
And
it's
I
really
think that's
true.
such a neat thing. You get so much more perspective on so many different topics when you read, whether fiction or nonfiction. I think they both come into play with that.
No, absolutely. And I think in a way, writing a book is also like having another life. Gives you a whole other level.
Yeah, definitely. But I did want to give you a chance to read some of your work and share with our audience.
Okay, I'd love to. I'll read a few pieces from Stash. I'm going to read a poem in Stash called Plum Brandy, which is about a Monet painting, a painting that I've loved for a very long time and identified with the painting and then saw it hanging in a different kind of show in Chicago with more information about the painter. So, Plum Brandy. I'm smiling, but she doesn't smile back. My old friend. The painting by Monet, girl in pink with a cigarette, untouched plum and brandy in the glass before her. She's caught in that pensive moment before anyone, even the waiter, can ask for or offer her something, as if I saw for an instant my own face, young in the mirror, sweet-shaped, passably pretty, brown-haired, waiting, not for life to begin, as that has already happened, but for the moment to unpause from its suspension, lurch forward into its larger meaning. Crowded museum, city street, skyscraper, sinking into the lake, the painter dying paints some oysters on the shell, ready to eat, a pile of joyous peaches, a heap of orange mandarins, bouquets in a water glass that don't seem to speak of loss. Monet says, and I paraphrase, these moments may not mean much to some, but a great deal to us. And I also was planning to read Summer, which you had asked about. It's a little short prose piece just at the end. The last piece is called Winter, so I'll read Summer and then Winter. Summer. We lie on the lawn and eat what we can forage, mostly tasty onion grass. I pick three-leaf clovers and peel another leaf to add to them. Look, four-leaf clover, I tell my dubious younger siblings. What's this? My brother holds up a tiny daisy. A daisy, I say. No, he says, a sunflower, only very, very far away. He will grow up and become an architect. My father is out with a weed killer and a spike tool that pulls up roots. It is a 2-acre lot. That is a lot of weed. The lawn is mostly bluegrass, but it also has its primeval edges, moss, violet forage. Once we see a caterpillar wasp paralyze its prey and lay its eggs at the still living mass of protein. It is just this wasp that made Darwin doubt a benevolent God, but we are children. As such, we know only God's tyranny and the random cruelty of the universe. The wasp does not bother us. It is just following its nature, as is my father, spraying and pulling. He works the front lawn while we sit in the back, blowing every dandelion head that comes to hand. The lovely fairy-winged seeds float innocently on our breath, looking to land. And this piece is called Winter, and it's a one-line haibun, which means one line of prose and a haiku. Evening, snow so cold, new notebook. Soon I'll be leaving a line of footprint on the blank page. So that's a few pieces from
Excellent.
Stash.
Thank you so much. That was a great one to end on. Well, thank you so much, Miriam, for taking the time to come
My
on the
pleasure.
show. Really appreciate that. And would definitely love to have you back talking about your writing and what you've got going on.
Anytime, and I'm glad you're doing the show, and have a good week with it.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.